This is the first of a series of five, let us hope, although you don't have to hit all of them, you might find it of interest. There is a kind of a sequence here. Today we're going to talk about Bonhoeffer was wrong, and I'll explain more about that in a minute. On Tuesday, tomorrow, I'm going to go more deeply into what I'm calling the theme for the whole week, that is to say, the ecumenical consensus in worship. You're living in a day of exciting ecumenical, worldwide, inter-church cooperation, agreement, and consensus in worship. And I'm going to spell that out a little better on Tuesday. On Thursday, we won't be meeting on Wednesday. Wednesday, I'm going to take off on a little hike. On Thursday at 10:30, in here again, I'm going to talk about four pathologies in Lutheran worship. On Friday in the afternoon, I'm going to continue what I began on. They're all related. They're all part of what I see as the ecumenical consensus. I'm calling it, not since before the Reformation have we seen such a consensus, such an agreement as to what worship means and how it ought to be done. And then Saturday in the afternoon again, worship and what you might call entertainment evangelism. This comes out of the so-called church growth movement, and you may have heard about the mega churches that are putting on a big kind of a tent revival show, only in modern glitz. And I want to talk about worship as it relates to that. Okay, we've sung a hymn. I've told you the shape of the whole week. Let me begin by telling you a true story. I was invited to be the officiant at the wedding of the mayor of our town. It's not a big town, but I had come to know the mayor. It was a woman mayor, as a matter of fact, and her husband. And it was her daughter who was going to get married, their daughter, who wanted to get married, and she knew me too, and she asked me to tie the knot, although they were not Lutherans. I said, sure. And the day of the wedding came, and it was to be an outdoor wedding in the mayor's garden. Very lovely garden, tent set up for reception. But we were to have the ceremony by the rose arbor. And 5 minutes before the ceremony, great black clouds rolled in, and thunder and lightning began to play back and forth. And the father of the bride came up to me, and I had my collar on. And he said, with your connections, he said, can you do something about this weather? And I said, gee, Glenn, I wish I could help you, but I'm only in sales. I'm not in management. That was not an original joke with me, but I thought it was kind of funny. You know, parish pastor in sales, not management. Then I read a book by John Updike. Any of you fans of John Updike? Roger's Version, you ought to read that book. Wonderful. It's about a parish pastor who is now a teacher at a seminary. And he's, at one point in the book, he's in conversation with his niece. And his niece says, Uncle Roger, you're really a salesman, aren't you? A salesman for the gospel, a salesman for religion. And Roger says, well, when I was in the parish, I was in sales. But he says, now that I teach at seminary, I'm in quality control. And I kind of like that, too. And I've been teaching at a seminary, a couple of seminaries, as a matter of fact, the last 12 years. Not that long, 8 years. And I like to think that what I did there had the character of quality control. That is to say, I want to send out seminarians with a good product. Of course, we know the gospel is a good product, but we want to make sure that they understand it and appropriate it and take it to themselves, not just a head trip, but also in the heart and even in the hand, that they're good mechanics with what they do, that they look comfortable standing at the altar with the cup and that kind of thing. Anyhow, I see these sessions, too, as having some of that character. That is to say, what we're talking about this week, in my sessions anyhow, has the character of quality control. That is to say, we are looking at the whole life of the church, particularly from the standpoint of worship, and we're trying to say, what's good here, what's bad here, what needs to be changed, what do we want to hang on to, stuff like that. Well, having put all of that on the table, let me tell you about my own approach to this. You might even say my own prejudices, I suppose, and tell you a story. I think it's apocryphal. It sounds too good to be true, but maybe it's a true story. It's about a visitor to the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. Any of you been there? Florence, Italy? The Uffizi Gallery, one of the great art galleries in the world. I mean, they got Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and Botticelli and all of these great artists on display. and a tourist was walking through the corridors and through the galleries and being very scornful. Oh, I don't like that painting. It's too dark, and I don't like that one. And, oh, my child could do as good as that. I mean, he was being very kind of disrespectful. And a guard at the museum couldn't take it any longer. And the guard said, "Sir, these paintings here are not on trial. You are. You are." I like that. There's a sense, in other words, in which our tradition judges us. I heard a wonderful definition for a tradition. A tradition is a way of giving your grandfather and your grandmother a vote in the decisions that you must make today. Isn't that nice? Transgenerational democracy. Not the only vote, not the deciding vote necessarily, but we ought to have grandpa and grandma in on the conversation. And that's what a tradition does for you. So I am very unashamedly a fan of the tradition. And by the tradition, I mean that great tradition that stretches back to the apostles and goes all the way through now, what, 2,000 centuries of Christian history. And that tradition, I'm not going to say everything in that tradition is worthy or great, but I'm going to want to listen to it. And I'm going to want to listen to what grandpa and grandma loved and their grandpa and grandma loved. I don't think, you know, Oedipus was the person who murdered his own father. And we don't have to be Oedipus to be a contemporary person. To be a contemporary, adult, mature person, you do not have to reject your parents or your grandparents. In fact, I would say it's a mark of maturity if a new generation can learn to try to love what grandpa and grandma loved. And you won't be able to do it all the time, but I think it's a mark of maturity. If I can somehow try to learn to love what grandpa and grandma loved, that's a mark of my own maturity. And there's even a sense in which grandpa and grandma's tradition that I have now judges me and puts me on trial. Now, I'm here to argue and to state the case these next 5 days, 6 days, that what we've got in our own era is an altogether unprecedented ecumenical consensus in worship. Not just in worship, but in a lot of things. I'm going to hold up these two books, and you can find them at the bookstore. One is called Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, and the second is my own volume. I wrote an essay in this called What is Contemporary Worship? And it's in a little series of volumes called Open Questions in Worship, edited by Gordon Lathrop. Some of you know Gordon. He was here at Holden Village, I think, on at least one or two occasions, if not more. Anyhow, you might find both of these books useful. This book, particularly, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, is an altogether unprecedented book because it brings together the conclusions of scholars and teachers and preachers and pastors and educated lay people from all of these traditions. Get this. See if I can find it. All the major church traditions: Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, and Pentecostals even. All of them had a hand in shaping this book. And this book takes a look at baptism, Holy Communion, and even ministry, and comes up with conclusions that everybody could agree upon. So, we're going to examine this in more detail tomorrow. Yeah, we're going to examine that in more detail tomorrow. But first of all, let me take a look at Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer is one of the Lutheran saints. You know, he's one of our heroes, and rightly so. And he was right about a lot of things. But I think he was wrong when he said, following Karl Barth — Karl Barth was the big theologian in the first part of the century, one of the big theologians. Anyhow, Barth was very suspicious of the word religion. He thought religion was climbing Jacob's ladder on our own and trying to reach God or trying to please God somehow by something that we did ourselves. And of course, everybody in this room knows that that's works righteousness. I mean, That's the wrong way of looking at the gospel. And Karl Barth said that the Christian faith is not a religion in that sense. And the religion is a human endeavor where you're trying to figure out, you know, spiritual values and so on. And Karl Barth said, no, the Christian faith is God coming to us, not us coming to God, God coming to us. Pitching a tent with us, sharing life with us. And so I think that was a word that we had to hear back in those days. And Bonhoeffer followed that and said, yes, the day is coming when the Christian faith will be without religion. It'll be a religionless Christianity. Now, what exactly he meant by that, we never know, because he died, as you may know, a martyr to the Nazis. He was executed by the Nazis. So we don't know exactly what he might have meant by that. A lot of people have interpreted him to say that religion is going out of style, or religion is some kind of relic of the past, and the Christian faith is going to leave religion behind. Well, I'm going to try to make the case today that you can't do it, and that religion is always going to be with us, and further, that maybe it isn't so bad, and that religion is part of the flesh that the Word takes when it comes to dwell among us. Let me spell it out to you in terms that I heard spelled out. Back in 1963, I heard a lecture by an Anglican, I think he was, Episcopal theologian called William Klebsch. Any of you know William Klebsch? Has he ever been to Holden Village, for that matter? Sharp fellow. Anyhow, he talked at this lecture back in 1963. I think that was the year before some of you were born. Anyhow, in 1963, he gave a lecture about the death of Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe had died that summer, and this was just a couple weeks later. And he said, you know, Marilyn Monroe didn't commit suicide. And we all pricked up our ears. No, she took pills, you know, and she died that way. He said, what happened was a nice little girl from Ohio by the name of Norma Jean Baker was murdered by Marilyn Monroe. And we had to think about that. You know what Marilyn Monroe's real name was? Norma Jean Baker. And I think she was in Ohio. She lived in Ohio. She had a terrible childhood, very dysfunctional family, abused, raped, I think, at the age of 16. I mean, she just had a terrible background. But she grew up to be a beautiful and lovely young woman, and she got to be a Hollywood star, and she had a nice little comic gift. You ever see something like it, Hot? One of the all-time funny movies. Anyhow, the problem was that little Norma Jean Baker from Ohio could never come to terms with her outward persona as Marilyn Monroe. And this lecturer, William Klebsch, was making the case that it was her outward sex goddess image, if you want to put it that way, was responsible for murdering this nice little girl, Norma Jean Baker. And, says William Klebsch, isn't it a shame? Couldn't people have helped her to find some way to live out that life with some kind of integrity and some kind of joy instead of snuffing it out at a young age? Then he said, all of that is an analogy, a metaphor for faith and religion. And he said, faith is always at the point of being murdered by religion. And what he said was this: faith is your posture of trust and love towards God and towards your neighbor. That's faith. And it's the gift of the Holy Spirit. But you have to live that faith out somehow. And that faith lives out in very human ways. You're worshiping God, and you have certain prayers. And if you're not using the prayers in this book or the hymns in this book, well, you're using some other hymn book, right? Same with doctrines and understandings of what this all might mean. Creeds, dogmas the Roman Catholics talk about. You have to be able to explain this all somehow. And that comes out as creeds or doctrines or dogmas. Ethics, how about living the life of faith? You've got to make some choices, and boy, they're tough choices sometimes, ambiguities and compromises with what you think is the best. But you still have to, as Martin Luther says sometimes, sin boldly and go ahead and say your prayers, ask for forgiveness. But that's the life of ethics, for Lutherans anyhow. And even church structure. You know, here we got the ELCA. What does that mean? Is it organized the best way it can be? Well, I don't know. Maybe you could toy with it and make it better in this way or that. But you're never going to do without some kind of structure, some kind of organization or constitutional, institutional form. I heard a friend who says, Jesus promised that where two or three are gathered together, there will I be in the midst of them. And I think that's true. But he went on to say, there you will also find a president, a secretary, and a treasurer. I mean, that's just human, right? And you can't do away with those things. I like to talk about religion, therefore, as having the character of the what I call the four C's. Creed, that's what you believe. Your doctrines, your dogmas, your faith, and how you explain it. Code, that's ethics, how you live out that life, sometimes sinning boldly. Cult, that's worship. And as I say, if you're not worshiping in this kind of a space with this kind of a chair arrangement, you're worshiping in another kind of chair arrangement. If you don't use this book, you're using another hymn book. If you don't use these prayers and these forms and these liturgies, doesn't mean you don't have any. Just means you got some other ones. There's no such thing, in my view, as a non-liturgical church. Every church is liturgical. You have to have some kind of praying, some kind of hymns, some kind of Bible reading, some kind of preaching, right? And if you don't have the ones we're used to, you just got some others. It's not a case of never having them. You have them, sure you do. Cult is the word that the anthropologist would use. It's an unfamiliar term to most of us, but it's a pretty good word. And then even the fourth one, a constitution. Am I spelling this right? Spelling is not my long suit. Constitution. You know, president, secretary, treasurer. You have to have some kind of organization to get the job done. And all of that, dear friends, I would call religion. And Bonhoeffer was wrong, and Barth was wrong. They might have been right on a lot of other things, and I think they were. But I think they're wrong if they believed that Christianity or the Christian faith could ever do without that stuff. You have to have it. It's the way faith works out. It's the way faith finds its expression. And we always ought to be careful because, like Marilyn Monroe and Norma Jean Baker, religion is always at the point of murdering faith. Go ahead.
So in other words, the decently and in order that Paul spoke about in Corinthians is the four C's. It's the human decency and an order.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Good point. I see what you're talking about. Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. It's simply part of the human package. And it's part of, you might put it this way, it's part of the first article of the creed. God made human beings in such a way that they need that stuff. And if they don't have it, they'll invent it. I could give an illustration here of Sarah Shantz and her cereal. I stayed overnight with a friend in Toronto. We live about an hour from Toronto, and that's where the big airport is, so we fly in and out of Toronto. And Bob said, my friend, he said, come and stay overnight with us. I had to catch a flight early in the morning. He said, stay overnight, have breakfast with us, and we'll get you to the airport in the morning. So I said, it's fine. So 6 o'clock in the morning, we're having breakfast around his table, he and his wife and his little kids. And little Sarah is maybe, what, 4 years old, 5 years old? Very young, anyhow, in her high chair. And she's watching while her dad prepares her cereal. And he puts the cornflakes in the bowl, and he sprinkles the brown sugar on the top, and he picks up the cream pitcher. And little Sarah, sitting in her high chair with her eyes half closed, almost asleep, says, not on the sugar. She didn't want him to pour that cream over the sugar. She wanted him to pour that cream down the inside of the bowl so as not to melt the sugar. You see what I'm saying? That was her little liturgy. That was her little ritual with the way she ate cornflakes. And human beings are full of that stuff. Human life would be terrible if we didn't have those little liturgies, those little rituals. The way you brush your teeth in the morning, the way you arrange your space when you go to work on Monday morning, the way you cuddle with your spouse in bed. I mean, all of those are certain little rituals that give meaning to your life. And they're not just private and personal, they can also be social and corporate and public. 4th of July, patriotic parade. Opening night of the symphony orchestra season, when you see everybody in a tuxedo and a long dress, that kind of thing. A barbecue in the backyard, you know, with the barbecue going and people standing around with their blue jeans on and their sandals. I mean, there's a certain way of doing things that people get used to, and our life would be inhuman without it. If I can just conclude what Klebsch was arguing when he talked about Marilyn Monroe, he says, in the same way that Norma Jean Baker, in a sense, was murdered by her own embodiment in Marilyn Monroe, so in the same way faith is at the point of being murdered by religion all the time. And you know that sometimes our creeds get in the way of our preaching. And our behavior and ethics code that does not preach the gospel the way it ought to. And our worship sometimes gets in the way of people coming to God. And our constitution, of course, too, our institutional forms, they can get in the way. May I say, every institution in human life has this problem, including education and medicine and so on. You know, you go to schools and you can say, golly, if this place were only a little better, the educational system at this school is standing in the way of me learning something. And it happens. Same with hospitals and medicine. The medical system is standing in the way of people coming to health. A lot of times. Not always, but a lot of times. So faith is always at the point of being murdered by religion, and we want to make sure that it doesn't happen. As much as is in our power, we want to make certain that that does not happen. And that's the job of theology. Klebsch went on to say that theology is a way of kind of straightening out faith and religion and keeping them separate and keeping one transparent to the other. That may be a good way of putting it. Wouldn't it be nice if Sunday after Sunday, our liturgy and our worship was transparent to the gospel, our faith? Wouldn't it be nice if our behavior was transparent to our faith? Wouldn't it be wonderful if our creeds and our doctrines and our ways of expressing it was transparent to our Christian faith? Same with our organization or institution, all this decently and in order stuff.
If they were only the enabling things that help the faith happen.
They ought to enable, exactly. And the trouble is, a lot of times they don't enable. And then you've got to send in the quality control people and clean things up. And that's how I regard my position here. So, these presentations, therefore, have some of the character of shop talk. This is not necessarily the kind of stuff that I would preach on a Sunday morning in the pulpit, but I think it's important conversation to talk about these matters, as we will be during the rest of the week. So these four C's, creed, code, cult, and constitution, it seems to me, are useful categories and make some sense. I would further distinguish between religion and revelation. I'd like to take my blue. Here's my blue. Revelation is God coming to us in Christ and in Scripture and in bread and cup and in the water of baptism. That's all something that you didn't invent yourself. That's God coming to you. That's revelation. But religion, then, is revel. Is that right? Am I spelling that right? Revelation? No, revelation. That's right, isn't it? Reveal, yeah. Okay, revelation and religion. This is religion, and it can get in the way of this. and it's kind of a shame. Lutherans, my perception among Lutherans is that we're pretty good at revelation, but not so hot at religion. And as a matter of fact, we can be kind of suspicious of religion. And it's almost as if we turn our back on the first article of the creed. I argued that this is part of the human picture, these religious categories that I've talked about, creed and code and cult and constitution. And Lutherans are sometimes kind of suspicious of that. We're going to get into that more on Thursday for pathologies. In any case, revelation, I would say, is God's own self-disclosure to us in Israel and in Jesus, and it's something that you have to learn. It's something that you have to be taught. It's not something you can invent out of your own psyche. Somebody else has to tell you. Somebody else has, your parents, your teachers, your pastor, your friend, somebody else. Philip, and the Ethiopian eunuch, read that marvelous Bible study a few minutes ago. Wonderful stuff. Somebody else has to bring it to you. That's revelation. Religion, well, we can invent some of those things, can't we? We can play around with them and say, well, if this system doesn't work, we'll try another system. You don't like these hymns, we'll try some other hymns. You don't like these ways of organizing the church, synods or conferences or whatever, we'll try a different way. That's our privilege. But we want to see as much as possible that all of this is transparent to the gospel and to Christian faith. Okay. I could even throw a Latin term at you, couldn't I? Larvae Dei. That's a wonderful term from Martin Luther. He probably got it from the Catholic tradition. That is the Roman Catholic tradition in which he was raised. Larvae Dei. The masks of God. Larva is a mask, literally. And Luther was fond of talking about the larvae dei, the masks of God, that you can see God hidden, but also revealed in all of these things, creed, code, and constitution, and so on. You can see God in nature, right? You can see God in the daily newspaper. You can see God in a relationship with a friend. A lot of places you can find God. And they're all masks of God. God speaking to you, God present there, God addressing you, but also somewhat hidden. There's that mask there. And the mask both hides and reveals. Okay, ritual and routine. I heard a neat distinction between ritual and routine that might be worthwhile taking a look at. Ritual is something that you do over and over again that you would miss if you did not do it. Routine is something you do over and over again that you would not miss if you did not do it. And the speaker was in a marriage counselor and said, let's take a look at some of the rituals that make your life richer and fuller. The way you brush your teeth, let's say, or the way you arrange your workspace and so on. Those are rituals that make your life, little Sarah with her breakfast cereal cream going down the side of the bowl. You know, that was important to her. Well, you can make up your own rituals and see in your own life how these rituals enrich you and make your life fuller. Routine, that's like taking out the garbage every Thursday. I got to take out the garbage every Thursday. And that does not make my life richer. And I could do away with it quite easily. But, and again, the problem is that rituals tend to become routine. And we got to see to it that doesn't happen. We got to make sure that our faith and our gospel can shine through our ritual. So ritual is not a naughty word for me, as it might be or might have been for Bonhoeffer or for Karl Barth, but I think ritual is simply part of the flesh that the word takes when it comes to dwell among us. And we can't do without it. Now our homework, therefore, is to take a look at how all of this relates. And as I say, that's partly the job of theology, to take a look at faith and religion and see how they relate. How are we doing here in terms of time? Let me say a word about high church and low church. And let me give you two illustrations. A couple of years ago, I had a study lead, and we lived in Europe for 11 months. And part of that time, we were in England. And my wife, who sits here doing some handwork, she is a family life educator. And there was an international family life education conference in the city that we were living in at the time. This was Leeds, Northern England. Any of you know Northern England? Very lovely part of the world. And we were living in that city, and there was this international conference in Kathy's Field, and she was invited as part of this conference to the Lord Mayor's banquet that was to be the climax of this conference, week-long conference. And her spouse was invited too. So the two of us went along to the Lord Mayor's banquet. And we didn't know whether we should get all dressed up or not. We figured we should. I don't think Kathy had a long evening gown with her, but she put on a nice dress, and I put on my clerical collar. And we walked up the steps where people were already beginning to gather, and a gentleman came down the steps toward us and said, "Your name, please." And I thought, oh, I forgot to bring the invitation with me. I bet he's going to throw us out. But that wasn't his motive. I told him my name, Reverend and Mrs. Paul Bosch, and with that, he turned around at the top of the steps and said, "Reverend and Mrs. Paul Bosch." He was announcing us, like in the movies. I mean, have you ever had that happen? And every eye turned on us, and here was the mayor with his chain of office around his neck, and here was the lady mayoress. We shook their hand, and the chairman of the conference and his wife and so on. We went inside, and we had sherry and cheese and crackers. It was very, very lovely. Came time for the meal itself, and we went into the banquet hall and the Leeds town hall, I think it was. And here we had the fanciest meal I've ever had. You sat down at the table, and here were three or four forks and three or four spoons, and you weren't quite sure what to do with any of them. A linen napkin for your lap. There was a soup course and a fish course and a meat course and a dessert, and there was wine, different wine with each of those courses. I mean, it was the fanciest meal I've ever had. And I loved every minute of it. It was fabulous. I mean, we had a nice conversation around the table where we were sitting, and it was wonderful food, and I mean, it was very, very fancy. Now, contrast that again with the backyard barbecue. There are times when a backyard barbecue is awful nice too, right? You come there in your blue jeans and your sandals, and you stand there with your can of beer or your can of Coke or whatever it is, and you know, you're chatting up your friends, and you have a hot dog or a hamburger in your hand. You know, it's very much more informal, right? And you don't have to get all dressed up in your dark suit or your long dress or whatever. What's the difference between the meal at the Lord Mayor's banquet and the meal at the backyard barbecue? Well, how you dress, the etiquette, the kind of table linen that you have, and the number of knives and forks. I mean, all of that is kind of superficial. You'll have to agree with me, right? What's important is that at both of these, you get nourished, you get good food, and you have good human companionship. Now, I'd like to think that that's high church and low church. And there's a time, I think, for high church, when you pull out all the stops, maybe an ordination at a synod convention, and you have trumpets and timpani, and you have a procession with banners, and, you know, you really put on the dog, and have a choir, mass voices singing, that kind of thing. I mean, that would be splendid. And I would like that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Even incense, you know, that's part of the Bible. Psalm says, sing unto the Lord a new song. Play on the instruments, you know, timbrel and trumpets. And my prayer is going to rise before you like incense. I mean, that's all in the Psalm. So we have permission to use all of that stuff. But it's awfully nice, too, to have a campfire sing at the Bible camp where you pass the bread and the cup around the campfire and you're all much more informal. And that's perfectly legitimate too. So I would like to think that there's a place for both. And I would like to think that inside me, there's a high church person and a low church person. And just because, in one setting I like one kind of thing, and another setting I like another thing, that doesn't necessarily mean one is naughty and the other one, you know. I think we ought to be able to respect both of those forms. And I would like to even think of this. Let's think of high church, in terms of high education, or high competence, or even high enthusiasm. I mean, that's the kind of world I live in. Kathy's mother came over from the old country and finished eighth grade. Kathy has a master's degree, and our daughter has a PhD, and she just got tenure at the University of Kentucky. I mean, that shows, you know, you're going to find people in your congregations who have a lot of competence and a lot of high education. And I think that's neat. We ought to be able to speak to those people and bring the gospel to them on their terms. So I would make no apology. I live in a high world, high competence, high enthusiasm, high education. My worship ought to be high in that sense. But it also ought to be low, too. What's low in the sense of reaching deep down into human experience and human life, not being superficial. Low in the sense of getting below the surface into what is real and deep and meaningful. The low church people at my seminary, when I was a kid, when I went to seminary, they wanted you not to be a phony when you were in church, when you were in the chancel. And I think that's great. I don't want to be a phony up there. I want it to be the real me. So, sure, I live in that kind of a world too, and I want that to show. I want to be low church too.
But let's not mix them.
Pardon?
Let's not mix them.
Well, yeah, I think you can mix them.
In the same service?
Well, in a sense, yes. There would be times when we want to move more to the high church end of things, like at a synod meeting, you know, when you have the trumpets and the timpani and all that, and the procession. And there might be times when you want to have things a little more simple. But last night, I would give an example. Last night's worship here was both high and low in the best senses. That singing, wasn't that wonderful? And the psalm, that girl who sang the verses of the psalm, and we sang the refrain, that really spoke to me. Boy, that was a sublime moment.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that where I've been sometime, where the clergy will come in all their vestments.
Yes, that's the promise, isn't it? That we will see God face to face.
And will that be a mask also?
And the mask, well, that's hard to say. I like to think that heaven or the kingdom of God or the reign of God or whatever you want to call it would be a place where you wouldn't need those masks. But I think in this life you need them. And there's a sense of protection about that too. You know, Moses, God wants to protect Moses from his own glory. You know, and I'm going to pass by and I'm going to put my hand over you as you hide in the cleft of the rock. You remember that story? So there's a sense in which those masks that God uses are for our own protection. And the Hebrews used to think that if you saw God face to face, you would die. Now I think we have seen God at work in nature, as I say, in human history, in the relationship with friends and family, loved ones, in the gospel, surely, in the bread and the cup of communion, in the water of baptism, in preaching, in hymns. You know, you see God in all these masks. And the mask can get in the way, I have to admit that. But it also is there to reveal and to protect us. Go ahead.
I just finished reading Sproul's The Holiness of God. And he talks about Isaiah's vision.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really explain, you know, what Isaiah didn't explain what he really saw, but he said he saw the Lord. And Sproul goes on to say that even the inanimate doorpost had the good sense to shake.
Very
part
good.
Of God's creation had the sense to
Excellent. And God comes in the shape of an angel, you know, or the seraphim with the six wings and so on. I think you could say from a Lutheran perspective, anyhow, this may not be what other Christians think, but I think from a Lutheran perspective, God always comes in, this is Karl Barth now, Calvinist, mediated immediacy. Isn't that nice? A mediated immediacy. God is always immediately present there, but it's mediated. There's a mask, there's a larvae dei present. Go ahead.
You just said that you had that Bonhoeffer title just as a teaser. And isn't that what entertainment evangelism is doing? Trying to find new ways to
You got me there. I guess so. Yeah, there probably should be a little bit of that.
The heart of the message isn't any different then.
Yeah. Yeah, we're gonna talk about that more fully. When what day is it?
Saturday, I guess.
But I think we ought to have the best, the best competence we can at the service of the gospel. Something else. Let me give somebody else a chance. Then I'll come back to you. Anyone else?
You know, when you gave the four C's up there, like in religion, I can't help but thinking how in our life. They're okay. I'm not sure Bonhoeffer was wrong.
Sure.
But that we expect other people to accept our four C's, and we've got to learn
our version.
Our version. And we've got to learn to live with other people's views also.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to make the case on. What day is it? Thursday. Yeah, the four pathologies there. I'm going to try to make the case that what every Christian group has to do, and this goes for Lutherans and Methodists and Presbyterians and Roman Catholics and Orthodox and all we have to do is somehow clean up our own house in such a way as to move from what I would call sectarianism to what I would call a more Catholic view of things. Now that's Catholic small c. Small c. And even the Roman Catholics have a lot of homework to do. To be more Catholic. What is the meaning of the word Catholic, dear friends?
It's universal.
Yeah. I learned this just a couple years ago that it is a combination of two Greek words, kata and philon, and it means pertaining to the whole, pertaining to all that is. And if my tradition, as I like to think of it, is Catholic, small c, that means it pertains to the whole of human life. It's not sectarian, it's not one little piece, but it's everything. It's the whole human picture. And that's a good word. We should rescue that word, I think, and not let the Roman Catholics have exclusive use of it. That word is too good. All Christians could call themselves Catholic. And all Christians, including Roman Catholics, have the job of being more Catholic, small c, and less sectarian. I want to bring up your statement. Can you say it again for everybody? And then we'll come over here.
Okay, if you're thinking in terms of high competence, say in education, for example, that person, you may find somebody of low competence who has a deeper faith.
Right. You can find smart people who are kind of obnoxious or who are not faith-filled.
And I said to my mom, was only able to have a fourth grade education. Her brothers were educated, but their old German father didn't believe in letting the girls.
But she had a rich faith.
She had a rich faith.
And a grown-up
faith. And a self-education, that was my
own. Right. That's a good point. Go ahead.
Two things, just the word kata. If we read the Greek New Testament, the Gospel according to John is kata Ioanne.
That's right, yeah, pertaining to or according to.
Yeah, and then again, from our Lutheran perspective, I learned that God reveals himself in the opposite. So,
In the
opposite.
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 Opposites.
I mean, if something comes to you, well, in despair, in disease, in sickness, in whatever is negative for us, and we would like to expect something glorious.
Yes, good point.
God reveals himself in the opposite.
A lot of times. Very good point. God reveals in the weak, the weakness, and you know, St. Paul says that, doesn't he? And we talk about the theology of the cross, do we not? You know, here is a crucified felon who is our Christ. Yeah, that's a good point. So it's not all glorious, by no means, no. Something else? Go ahead.
I can't resist a further comment on your creed, code, cult, and constitution. They seem much softer as you go downward on that list. The top two would seem to be, most of which hold fairly unchangeable. For instance, if cult means the manner in which the way we worship our liturgy, I think we need to be very open-armed toward other denominations. It may not mean I'm so open-armed, let's say, toward the Muslim way of doing it, or if they were offering children for sacrifice.
Yeah, right, right.
And so, but see, that's because that's a result of their creed or their code. So as much as we need to be open-armed, that discussion stops pretty quick if you run it into primitive practices.
Uh-huh. I'll have to think you're suggesting that there's a kind of hierarchy here, and that this is most important and this is least important, and I'll have to think about that a little bit. They all seem to me to have some importance, and I think they all can be corrupted and stand in the way of the gospel being preached or the gospel being made clearer. Something else, yes?
I was wondering if, and you know, like you said, Bonhoeffer died before we could really find out for sure where he
right.
was aiming toward, but I always felt that he was probably trying more to define Christianity than religion in his effort to make the divorce there. And he was probably hoping, just as we all are, that our four C's, he was trying to probably to transparentize the whole thing so that it would more enable faith.
It could well be.
Yeah.
It could well be. He didn't live long enough to spell that out.
Right.
I'm raising it partly as a teaser to get you in the door here today. But also, there is an opinion, I think, among a lot of Christians, including some Lutherans, that these four things, creed, code, cult, and constitution, are not important, or we don't have to give attention to them. But I think we do.
Yeah.
Something else? Liturgy. How about the word liturgy? You've heard what that means before. Liturgia. It means the work of the people. That's where the word liturgy comes from. So it's a good word. I think I would like to try to rescue the word religion. I would like to try to rescue the word ritual. Those are good words. And the word liturgy is a good word too. And it means the work of the people. And I would argue that everybody has a liturgy. Even the so-called free churches, if you've ever been to a Methodist church or Pentecostal or whatever, you know what's going on from one minute to the next. And the preacher, even if he's dreaming it up out of his head at the moment, the people know that there's a certain structure to what happens. Kathy and I were in Eastern Kentucky the year before last. I was visiting professor at Berea College. Any of you know Berea College? Wonderful school, Berea, Kentucky. I was visiting professor there, and they took us on a tour of Eastern Kentucky for a weekend that included attending an old regular Baptist church, old regular Baptist service. You never heard of the old regular Baptist, I'll bet. But it was wonderful. The service was 3 hours long. Are you ready for this? There were seven sermons. and there wasn't a hymn book or a bulletin in the pew. They all knew the hymns. I mean, it was wonderful. And they sang for half an hour before the service began. And if they didn't know, the there was a cantor, a singer, who lined out the words and sang, and the people would respond. It was marvelous. And there was a liturgy there. What I'm saying is, there was a form. You knew what to expect. The preacher, incidentally, in every case, some of the sermons were as brief as 5 or 7 minutes. A couple of them were 20 minutes. The preacher, when he really warmed, they were all men, and when he really warmed up, he started to chant. I want you to give your life to Jesus. I want you to give your life to Jesus right now. He had two little notes that he would, and each preacher has his own way of singing with different notes. It was very interesting. We understood that if you gave your life to Jesus right there in the service, they'd stop everything and take you down to the creek right outside the door of the building and dunk you, baptize you. Oh, dear. Anyhow, moving along. Anything else here? I don't want to cut off conversation.
Yeah, I guess in Lutheranism, we'd probably say that the Quakers had the most compact, but yet well-defined liturgy.
Yeah.
Because everybody there would understand what was copacetic, what wasn't.
I'm thinking of something, but I'll save that for another day. The question that I would love to raise and to answer is this. If an atheistic friend or a Buddhist or a Hindu or some non-Christian friend came to you and said, what is the gospel all about? I hope that you could say, come with me on Sunday morning and see it happen. Come with me on Sunday morning and see it working out among these people. The liturgy, as I say, is the work of the people. And we have this wonderful term for what we do on Sunday, Holy Communion. That is a corporate noun, friends. In other words, the Holy Communion refers to the bread and the cup, of course, but it also refers to us. We are the Holy Communion. And I think when Jesus at the upper room takes the bread in his hand and he says, this is my body, I think we are justified in saying, he's looking at the disciples at the same time, and he's saying, this is my body. You people are my body. And Susan, this morning in that Bible study, made the point how Philip took the place of Christ, replicating that Road to Emmaus story, now with the Ethiopian eunuch. And I hear the gospel asking you to take the place of Christ. And all of us together being Christ to each other. Martin Luther says that, doesn't he? He says we are to be Christ to each other. Incidentally, a lot of times you hear that translated, we are to be little Christ to each other. But I heard a Luther scholar, Eric Gritsch, has he ever been to Holden Village? Wonderful fellow, Gettysburg Seminary. He's looked all through Luther and he never finds that diminutive. He never finds the word little. In other words, it's just plain Christ. You are to be a Christ to your neighbor. I am to be a Christ to my neighbor. And boy, that's neat. And we are together, therefore, the body of Christ, we are together the Holy Communion. The Holy Communion, before it's the bread and the cup, is us. We are the Holy Communion. So the people are the most important symbol, if you want to put it that way, at worship. And it's the people who have the most important role. And the pastor and the preacher and the assisting minister and the lectors and the choir and the musician and the acolytes and the greeters, all of those people, they're supposed to simply help the people and their voice. And it's the people's voice that's important. You could change the figure. You could say that the actors on the stage are the people in the pew. And the minister and the preacher and the musicians and the choir and so on, they are the prompters in the wings, helping them to do their part. Or you could change the figure, you could say it's the people in the pew who are the team on the field, and the pastor and the preacher and the choir and the musicians and the assisting ministers and the acolytes and so on, they're the cheerleaders. And it's God who's in the stands. It's God who's in the audience. We're going to talk more about that audience and participant business tomorrow. and all through the week, because I think that is a very important thing about worship, that when you walk in the door of a Christian church on Sunday morning, you ought to feel invited to participate. Now, you may not be able to, and you may want to sit in the back row and watch. Lutherans are good at that, sitting in the back row. But you should feel invited, and you should feel invited on stage. You should feel invited to be a participant in this event, not somebody who's sitting there waiting for somebody to put on a show for you, but a participant yourself. You're the Holy Communion. Something else? Go ahead.
Forgive me for being coming from a different direction, for not
sure.
being Lutheran,
sure,
and wanting to understand something. Mm-hmm. The number of times that I've been here to Holden Village and participate in the services, or visited friends who are Lutheran and participate in their services, as a Christian, I come to the place which we were at the very beginning of the service last night, when we all read this prayer of confession, and I have a hard time reading the things that I just feel like, this doesn't apply to me. Today, I'm feeling excited about what God has done, how he's been working in my life, feeling really successful, and I have to come and say these negative words. And then I understand what you're saying, that we are saying them all for each other because somebody needs to say them. But it's hard for me to think that that's a part of my worship that's necessary as often as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you'll look in the Green Book anyhow, and the services that are in here too, and they all make the point that you don't have to have that confession at the beginning of the service. You can omit it.
And also, you know, where people get poetic and they might write their own confession and have everybody read it. And I think I like the quiet time, the prayer time, where you can just say your own confession.
Yeah, sure. You're not saying the confession itself
is wrong. That somebody else wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's hard sometimes to put yourself in somebody
yeah.
else's words.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I agree with you. Note at the beginning of our service, the brief order for confession and forgiveness, page whatever, may be used before this service. It says may be used. Don't have to use it every Sunday. And I think it would be wise not to use it every Sunday. If it were me, I would not use it on white Sundays, that is to say, Christmas and Easter, when the color is white, celebrated as, you know, festival days. I think I might want to use it in Advent
sure.
and Lent.
Sure. Don't we sin on those days?
Say it again.
Don't we sin on those days?
Oh, yeah, sure we do, sure we do. And then if you do omit it on those days, then you want to include a prayer like that in the intercessions, a prayer of confession. Oh, I get your point. You're tweaking my nose.
Okay. But part of corporate confession is strength that you receive.
Yeah, sure, yeah. I think we will all agree that we are sinners and that we make mistakes. But how you put that into a service, liturgical form, that's the question, you see. And our, you know, there are even some liturgical scholars who say it doesn't belong at the beginning of the service because it gives the impression that you got to clean up your act before God is going to come to you.
You wouldn't need the church if you.
Yeah. So you know that there are psychological questions as well as theological questions to ask when you write a liturgy. And writing a liturgy is no easy job. It's tough business. And it's probably good if it's done by a committee. The Green Book, for instance, is the most committed and field-tested and talked about and fought over book that you can imagine. I come out of the LCA tradition from the East, and I was appointed by the LCA to be among those people who had a meet twice a year when the Green Book was being put together, to vote up or down the stuff that appeared in it. I didn't write anything in the Green Book, but I was on the committee that had to give thumbs up or thumbs down. And let me tell you, we had some long, hard discussions. And some stuff is in there that I wish wasn't in there, and there's some great stuff that wasn't in there that I wish was. So, you know, you win a few, you lose a few. But that green book was very, very carefully researched and field tested. They sent it out before they published it, you know, to the parishes and asked people's feedback and so on. So we can be very proud of that green book. It's a wonderful book. Now, times have changed. It's 20 years later. We got a new book that's a resource that adds to the green book, but we should never reject that green book. That green book is wonderful stuff. There will be a time when there will be a purple book, and it'll leave the green book behind. But it'll build on the green book in the same way that the green book built on the red book or the whatever book you had. We got to quit, don't we? Yeah, oh my Lord, we do. Hey, this is fun. We'll see you tomorrow, perhaps.